Education in the Paperless Society. And in this essay, he not only predicted the internet, which he actually called the electronic highway, he also predicted Google, because he said, it's not a highway, it's an ocean, and we don't know where the shore is. And that's a kind of an amazing poetic understanding of the amount of information that was going to be set loose upon the world as his technologies evolved. And, you know, everybody in this room has a camera, right? You all have your own video cameras and your network interface right in your pockets. Back then, that wasn't even a fantasy. The idea of being able to create video, edit it, put information out into the world, we've already seen how it's changing global politics, how it's changing, you know, cultural norms, how it's changing society on a very basic level. That kind of thing was what was being debated and discussed in small groups. Artists were kind of fantasizing about it. Artists like Juan Downey, you know, set up this video Transamerica's.
Which is on view at MoMA right now.
That's true. It's great.
I got it. Well, yeah. But anyway, I want to go back to Namjoon and ETC. So Namjoon had many, many amazing ideas, like you said. He also really wanted the university system to change. So he envisioned within the SUNY State University of New York, New York State. He really lobbied. He did so many position papers, which are in various archives. So he did position papers for several of the SUNY campuses to have interdisciplinary faculty with, like, Yvonne Rainer, with dance people, with film people. And it was Jerry Brady. When did he get Buffalo? I think it was 71, 72.
Yeah, right around
the same time. So you had people within New York City, upstate New York, really sort of moving around and lobbying. But again, like we say, it was a marginal group, but yet they were with their BB guns.
Yeah, marginal isn't a marginal enough word for what we were.
But and then in MoMA, out of MoMA, for MoMA to give that space, even if it was shared with Thomas Wolfe's Lumia, it was a big deal.
Absolutely.
And I had Blanchette Rockefeller supporting me 120%. So I had Blanchette coming to me, you know, really wanting to know what video was. This was MoMA's chief trustee. I had Bill Paley having his engineers teach me and our two projectionists how to clean heads. You know, so it was, you know, like, it was like mom and pop, but, you know, it was.
And some of this attitude, which, okay, it is marginal, but isn't the art world, I mean, it's a marginal world of art in relation to culture at large.
It didn't stay marginal. It started out marginal, like, you know, there's a lot of art being made today that's marginal that no one in this room knows about.
That's
we still haven't seen, but it's going to have an impact. It's going to bubble up through culture and change things. That I have, I'm not a person of faith in a traditional way, but I have faith in that.
Yeah, in that sense. Although, I just wanted to reiterate how that sense of a political perspective brought to the technology was shared by so many people at that time. Not everyone who had the Sony report of that. Many artists, in retrospect, it's clearer to see, you know, made more gallery-specific and used the technology, not cavalier, but very with a lot of fluency.
There was a real split in the early video world. Artists who, you know, were interested in creating purely poetic experiences using this technology, and that was quite wonderful. Some of them were working with these new technologies like synthesizers. Some of them were just creating other poetic forms. And then there were radical journalists who recognized that they could directly take on the monster of broadcast television news and create a different kind of engagement, without a narrator, without the kind of point of view of some kind of corporate institution. There are some fantastic videos that were made by the people who became the video freaks during the trial of the Chicago 7. Interviews with Abby Hoffman, right after he'd been come off of testifying for Judge Julius Hoffman, David Dellinger, all people, and you know, they would talk for 20 minutes. There wasn't cutaways, it wasn't sound bites. It was the beginning of, you know, of substantive conversations using television, and that was a really radical thing, because we were used to what David Anton, this great art critic and poet, called the money metric, that we, you know, that we call sound bites. They were invented because television needed to compress discussion and talk into little bits that were easily fit between commercials.
So I want to also point out that also at this time, because we've mentioned some of the artists who've gone through ETC, like Woody and Stanley Masolka, but they, in New York, when they co-founded Kitchen, not the one on 19th Street, but this was on Mercer Street in the Mercer Hotel, not the hotel you know and have a drink at the bar. This was in the rundown, grotty.
The SRO Mercer Hotel.
SRO, where Namjoon stayed the first nights he was here, and he put a newspaper down because there were lice or whatever. But they were starting in the kitchen of the Mercer Hotel, the kitchen. And John Alpert, who started Downtown Community TV, also was programming. So you had, as we've already said, it was kind of this big, loose community who did, when they didn't have a camera, would share, who the independent voice was really important, whether that was political or not. And Ralph and Sherry were so important because they really dealt with practice and invited all kinds of people to come through. But the point I really want to make is that there was such mixing of disciplines. So Woody and Stena, at the very beginning, would videotape Jimi Hendrix at the Fillmore East. I would go to Max's Kansas City, and Andy Warhol and Lou Reed would be in the back room, and I'm sure some of you were there as well. You know, some of us, we maybe got to sit at that little that round table by the door, and that's where Chuck Close and Richard Serra, when they were wannabes, were sitting. Well, but later, you know, you heard Iggy Pop upstairs with his, you know, broken bottle, or you saw the latest chapter in Bethel Scott B's serial piece. So you had opportunities in all kinds of weird places because you pushed and you tried to get some club doyen to lend the equipment, you know, to do a show in that kind of space. So you just were doing.
It's kind of hard to imagine a pre-camera culture, you know,
right,
media saturated, being embedded in the public. The old Max's Kansas City was in the neighborhood and had some affluence, and therefore they had cable wired in, which many neighborhoods where we all lived did not. And so there would be screenings of artists, video by artists at Max's Kansas City, as public access, and this was a, you know, a very progressive and even aggressive inhabitant of the space that was simply not available to an individual because that space was television, you know. But with the arrival of cable, this notion of public access TV came into being, and artists seized upon that. Both producers and
but they lobbied, right?
So
that's George Stoney and Red Burns who lobbied, and
Didi Hallock.
They lobbied because the cable people were coming in, and it was clear they had the dollar signs in their minds, and so public access was something that they that the new cable stations had to do for churches, schools. You could book time. So Jaime Davidovich.
I've always thought that the real success of video was its failure to overcome the commercial interests that eventually dominated cable television, still dominated broadcast television, dominated the media in general. That failure taught artists a very important lesson, which was that you can't and could never rely upon the generosity of the corporate state for support, that you had to actually go out and do your own things. And that meant artist spaces, that meant artist-run spaces, that meant artist-run magazines, that meant artists finding ways of ignoring or sidestepping the power of the institutional and corporate structure. And that was very frustrating, because without that structure, you didn't have any access. But what eventually happened was that pressure remained in place, and then the tools to make use of that structure eventually emerged. I mean, the tools that we have in our pockets today. And yet the desire to create independent work and then to work outside of those structures, I think, did survive. And you know, even though the art world, the commercial aspect of the art world did absorb most of the video art and did wonderful things for some artists, made some of them very wealthy, brought some extraordinary works of art into public collections and into public consciousness. The real success for me of what Sherry and Ralph started in the Experimental Television Center, what was experimental, wasn't the material itself, it wasn't the medium, it wasn't the technology, it was the attitude. It was the idea that you could take on the idea of mass communications and invert it and say, it doesn't have to be point to space, it can be person to person. You can control that, it can be two-way. It doesn't have to be the fascism of one-way media. It can be, as Bertolt Brecht wrote in His Theory of Radio, it could be two-way, and that could change the way we understood the nature of media. I have a three-year-old grandson. He only understands television now because he has his mother's phone sometimes, and he pushes a picture of me, and I appear on his phone. And he says, Papa, do you have a chimney in your house? Or some question that a three-year-old would ask. Now, that's his idea of television, of media. You know, that you could just reach out and create a connection with some other person. He's not growing up thinking about television as just a device that makes you brain dead or whatever.
But I think too that the I don't want to stay since I'm on call for the evening, but an early one of the early perspectives in addition to taking on television, I think it's so interesting, was seeing the technologies potential for communication when there was nothing in place to suggest that. Nam-Joon saw that early. Kim Song-ye's numbers of artists and Kim Song-ye saw that early on and set up send-receive systems. So this technology had multiple ways of being used by different artists for notions of communications, for kinds of works that were very gallery specific, that they could survive and live in a gallery space. Yeah, I'm very sure of that. I mean, I think that when the Jonas and Vito and Nauman were first making that work, that they made that they got their eventualities to understanding a kind of durational time that could be seen in a non-screening setting. A non-screening setting was a setting they were all used to, which were galleries, and you could walk in on a video and 10 minutes into the piece, 17 minutes into the piece, it was the piece. You could appreciate it. You could be right there with it. And that, to me, is gallery specific.
Yeah, but Joan did study sculpture, but Joan really had a dance and a performance side. So,
well, I'm not denying that, but I'm saying that many people have found a way for a time-based medium mm-hmm. to survive in an ambient environment, which was the gallery. And I think it's an actual idea and insight on their part.
But okay. I think Vito is also another unusual character, and there were many unusual characters. So Vito coming out of poetry, putting the word on the page, feeling that was very architectural, local, his body is architecture. And then he had Ileana Sonovan, and she gave him a stipend, and he had the shows and the pieces in those spaces. So yes, the sense of space.
But each of the artists you just mentioned were using video as a kind of transitional medium to just play with ideas that didn't work in other ways. For instance, for Vito, he was trying to get away from his typewriter, trying to get away from the desk. He wanted to get out into the street. He wanted to literally leave the room. And so this video camera allowed him to do that. He wanted to create a different kind of, not communication, but communion. He wanted to find the way that a poet could communicate or connect with another person. So he made pieces like Face Off, where he imagined the viewer sitting right on the other side of that screen, and then he was just talking to this one person in a very intimate and sexualized way.
Yeah.
And so it was about, you know, finding ways of moving beyond that, you know.
But that's the point of the viewer, you know, that there was a shared topology that was approached but very differently. I'm not making a monolith of any of them. I think some people were very interested in two-way communication.
But there also was an enormous mistrust, and some of it was actually fostered by, you know, our friends at the New York State Council who kind of enjoyed this kind of division between the kind of
the
video people,
yeah,
community television people, and the high art, fine,
yes,
art people. And that distinction wasn't that clear on the ground. I mean, artists didn't really feel that, but I think the funding people, especially the New York State Council at the time, kind of proposed or pushed that in ways that I felt as somebody applying for grants in a museum. And that it was kind of unfortunate because I didn't really want to make those distinctions.
Yeah, because they were politically minded perspectives.
I just thought it was it was unfair to say that these artists who were creating fine art were not making political work, or that these artists who were changing the nature of the way journalism worked weren't in some way creating a different kind of art form, because I think they were. I think those long form, unedited, conversations and interviews were, when I look at them today, I think they're extraordinary. So I saw a conversation with Fred Hampton 1 week before he was murdered by the FBI. It's an amazing conversation that's on video. And he says, oh, they'd never kill me, man, because the next one would come by would be much tougher than me. I'm not afraid of being killed. 2 weeks later, he was shot in an FBI raid. And it's an amazing thing to see that document exist, unedited, without kind of a narrative. Here's Fred Hampton. He was a black man. He was like, just like a guy talking to another person. There's something essentially human about it. And that was very, for me, it was very empowering then, and even all these years later, when I see it, I think my breath's taken away by how extraordinarily important as a historical document these video, these tapes are. Thankfully, people like Barbara have been very involved in preservation too.
Acquiring them, preserving them.
Barbara, listen, I'm a big fan of Barbara Leibowitz. Barbara worked for, I'm not going to say how many years because she's still a very young woman, but she worked for so many years at the Museum of Modern Art. And I think she was completely underappreciated and not given the respect that she was due for her intelligence and her hard work and her absolute dedication to the growth of an art form. And Barbara, bravo.
But it's really interesting, when we think about the New York State Council, indeed, MoMA didn't get a grant from them. They got the NEA grant, and then it took like 5 years before NISCA gave a grant. They kept saying, I don't want to name who, anyway, but they wanted to see a commitment. But I mean, when Mrs. Rockefeller gives money, what else do you want? But those grants were very, very political. Those grants, because we were talking beforehand, Constance, about New York City, where we have a density, we have many, many, many artists. It's great that so many people are here. But the New York State Council on the Arts wanted to give money upstate. So some of these upstate places had great success, and it was important. They were bucolic, it was beautiful environment, rents were cheap, so you had communities of people. And people like Gary Hill wrote the grants for the Woodstock Community TV Center, where he was initially as a sculptor in like 73.
Oh, and that's really important to know, because I've always wondered like what was in the water. You had Syracuse, Binghamton,
I think it's
Buffalo, Alfred, all this upstate.
It wasn't in the water.
No, it was
the
individuals.
In the Kool-Aid.
But it's also like, I don't think universities really wholeheartedly supported it either. It was in Buffalo, you had a Jerry O'Grady, or you had a Ralph Hawking at Binghamton, and the experimental.
And Syracuse, they were very supportive, and Bill Viola got his start with
the
at the university when I was already at the museum.
And I want to ask you, because you were there, Bill talks about his professor, who Bill was sort of at a loss, and Jack Nelson got a video camera. Bill was very involved with the creation of Synax, which was a broadcast standard quality TV studio. And to me, that's the university thinking, we're going to give these people a trade.
No, that wasn't that. The Newhouse Journalism School had a broadcast division. And in fact, I was told that I should go there when I decided that after Woodstock and I saw a video,
right.
I was in the journalism school, not in the art school. I'm not an art, I didn't have an art education. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to work for the New York Times or something ridiculous like that. And when I saw a portable video at Woodstock, I went to my counselor and said, I'd like to do this. This is going to change journalism. He said, we don't play with toys here. We have a professional television school. Now, Steve Groth was on my floor as a freshman. He was in the journalism school. These guys were all very buttoned down, short hair, and kind of looking for television careers. And we were all long hair, hippie types. And so I took that as a challenge and went across the street to the art department. And that's where I met Jack Nelson, and Jack bought equipment for Bill and for me. Bill was a drummer and came out of advertising, and he didn't want to do that, but his parents would only let him be in art school if he would major in advertising, like a lot of parents. And so Bill and I started working together with equipment that this guy, who had no idea what video was, bought it for us. But Synapse was started, because they wanted to create something instead of a student union building. They basically took the money that the university had offered to students to stop shutting down the campus and burning down buildings and said, why don't you have a student union building? And this guy, Lance Wisniewski, took the money and bought broadcast television equipment and started a studio for artists there. It was quite a radical
idea.
And that's what Synapse started as. It no longer exists, but it wasn't part of the university. It was kind of slightly aside from that.
So it's interesting to hear, even for now with the devices that dangle from us and tether us at all times, that equipment had to be bought by an institution of some sort for a long time. That's how exotic in a way.
It was expensive.
And expensive.
Very expensive.
The equipment was so a gallery would buy it and the artists of that gallery would share it.
It wasn't just that it was expensive.
What about Leo?
Leo bought a camera for Bruce Nauman. Did he buy another one? I don't know.
I remember that Richard and Joan had.
Joan bought that camera.
That's second
one. And they shared it.
Yeah, that's
now, the equipment was very hard to find. There was a woman named Fujiko Nakaya from Tokyo who knew people in Sony, and she was an artist, and she was kind of doing video in Tokyo.
She was very close to Billy Kluver and experiments in art and technology.
So people would write to her, send her $2,000, and then she would send them a portapack.
And $2,000 was a lot of money back then.
Yeah, fairly inaccessible. So universities and
what I mean to say by that is that there wasn't a store you could go to and buy video equipment.
Right.
There was a place, C.T. Louis on the Lower West Side.
It was still there. Amazing things.
But he was a place that people bought video equipment. But there's nowhere to buy it. In Syracuse, we had to go to a business supply store that sold Selectric typewriters in Utica, and they had a video recorder. And that's where we bought them. Like, the guy didn't even know why we wanted it. They had one lying around. Because it wasn't on anybody's mind that you would make your own video, that you would have any use for this material, except maybe for security cameras, which is what Louis did.
Right.
Yes, we don't switch the use. But it's interesting that by 71, Kennedy Center got its legs, at least to begin with, when the technology was so useful, just beginning to be explored. And then I wanted to ask, wondered about what you thought about the sort of process nature of the so much work that was at the center, in that systems and DIY pieces of technology were made to do X, to do a certain thing, and almost as if the result in work was just simply the result of a process or a piece of technology. Is that an incorrect way of looking at their interest? I mean, it seems very experimental.
There were people who were instrument makers, machine makers, who really were interested in inventing these machines. And they made amazing things. I mean, Stephen Beck and Petra and,
Dan Sandin.
Dan Sandin. And a lot of them made, and a lot of people's names I never even learned. And some of them made really beautiful things come out of those machines, but very few of them were artists who were making interesting things. They were mostly kind of like engineers who had this idea to make a different kind of device, a device that could be then used. It's sort of like, I've invented the piano, now I'm waiting for somebody to come and learn to compose.
But they shared, yeah. And it was like the Ralph spirit.
Yeah,
of sharing.
It was very open, it was very hippie, it was very stoner. I mean, believe me, it was, I mean, a lot of that stuff was about, if you weren't high, sitting and watching it would be like dreadful. If you were high enough,
Well, that's
like your own light show in your own living room.
But see, I have to be very honest. You know, like, I really loved the work of Shigeko Kubota and Namjoon, really supported it. When I did the project show with Namjoon, of course, we had gotten already Global Groove into the collection. I showed in the project's exhibition the TV Buddha. Mm-hmm. Bill Rubin said, you have to wait 5 years for any of these projects' works to come into the collection. So of course that went immediately to the Stapler.
Right.
Then I waited years, I had long conversations with Kirk Barnadeau about Peg's work and trying to get one into the collection. It was not the museum's aesthetic. However, I tried to compare Peg and some of these assemblage-ish pieces with like Rauschenberg, and that they could do. That was easy. That they bought hook, line, and sinker. They had Sidney Janis and Leo talking it up.
Look, your work was truly
genealogy.
Your work was truly heroic, Barbara, and it's sad that you ran into such.
No, I'm just using it like, and I don't even.
No, but it is sad. The collection should have those works that you saw and that were being made then. But tell me honestly. When you walk through a big festival exhibition like a Venice Biennale or whatever, or an art fair, and you see so much video, and so much of it is really bad, don't you sometimes just say, oh my God, what have I done? Sometimes I think, I'm just being honest, sometimes I think that. It's like everybody makes video, everybody makes installations. It's like,
that's good. Yeah, 90% of it's bad.
But everybody makes
yeah, exactly. But I don't feel guilty. I don't feel guilty about having promoted painting. But I spent so much of my life promoting video, and then I'm thinking, like, oh boy, I should have said some video is interesting.
No, but when you go and you find young work, you know, like I went to the Greater New York a week and a half ago, and there's an artist who went through. Alfred was a student of Perbota. It's really phenomenal.
Oh, sure.
Sandra Perry, she's like, great.
Well, you know, what John Baldessari is reported to have said, he didn't actually say it, but it's such a great, he said, like, a video when it's a pencil, it'll have arrived, essentially, it'll be good.
Either he or Michael Snow, and they said it at the Open Circuit Theater.
Right, and I love these kind of apocryphal things. It was also on the front page of Art Right. There was that issue of Art Right magazine that had John Baldessari, image of a pencil.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not wrong. You know, the idea is that video is like a pencil today.
Right.
It's a totally common tool. Okay, not as common as we'd like it to be, but it's pretty common around the world, not just, that piece that Joanne Malinowska and C.T. Jasper did in the Venice Biennale this year, where they brought this Polish opera to this small village in Haiti. And it's an amazing, amazing four-channel video work, beautiful. And what you see in this little village in the central of Haiti, which was actually a place where a lot of Polish soldiers sent by Napoleon to defeat the slave rebellion in Haiti, they gave up on the slave rebellion and just decided to live there and become there. And so you see these kind of Haitians with kind of slightly Polish and blonde, you know, like features, and really amazing thing. But this is opera taking place on a crossroads there.
And the goats are walking through.
But everybody in the village has their video. You know, like all the people in the village, like taping the opera. It's like this is a small village in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, in a small agricultural town, and there were 60 people with video phones, you know, just taping the event. It made me think, yes, it's even more ubiquitous than we think. It's not just the first world. It's even third world cultures, in fact, have it as ubiquitous as first world cultures at this point. What's interesting,
like, it's gone through the same cycle in photography with the group. Because I remember when I went to Japan for the first time in the 70s, that there were these video festivals, and like JVC and different ones. And it was to try to get the consumer equipment, you know, out into the market. And, you know, everybody was doing in the community center painting, so then they were hoping they would do the video, but they were already doing photography. So it's like,
But the reality is that places like the Experimental Television Center or Video Free America in San Francisco and a number of places around the country that were active in the early 70s were having more of an impact in their own small way than the major art museums and art institutions, because they were open. Any artist could come in and work. They could create work. There was no institutional infrastructure that you had to deal with. And that was a very important moment. And they were part of that same growth of artist-run spaces. Mm-hmm. The kitchen, you know, didn't come out of nowhere. The kitchen was an institution of its time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's still an important institution, but it's a very different kind of institution today. But back when it was funky, the fact that it was funky was important. If it was slick, people wouldn't have, you know, it would have been, people wouldn't have felt comfortable, artists wouldn't have felt comfortable going there.
Yeah, artist-run, New York City was bankrupt. You had really cheap rents, you had yucky buildings, but yet the spirit, you went up a bunch of splintery stairs, it was dirty, grimy, amazing work was up there. And maybe it was Ira Schneider's Manhattan is an Island installation with all these monitors, and then maybe later that night it was Reese Chatham doing like 20 guitars, you know, blasting your earlobes out. So.
Is it starting to sound like a historical word, video?
Oh, it, for a long time.
Look, you know, because we keep saying it up here, and I'm thinking, and then you hold up your phone, and
in 1996,
it's starting to seem so
constant. In 1996, when we did Bill Viola's show, The Witness, I was standing there with around with a group of high school students, and they didn't see Bill, and we were standing around, and somebody says, "Isn't this cool? This is video," and like, one kid said to the other, "That's my father's video."
Yeah, I mean, it started to sound like that tonight.
I immediately felt old.
Yeah.
And I realized that it was true, that it was already generationally, the generation that was all excited about it, we were already in our 40s and 50s.
This isn't a receiver.
Well, it's
it
changed.
It makes it as well. I mean, I make work with it.
Somebody's calling.
But it's really morphed into media, didn't it, David?
Yeah, I mean, it's like,
the term is media.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, I remember having a conversation with Amy Talbot once, who both teach at the School of Visual Arts, and she's quite a brilliant critic. And she started off her conversation by saying, "There's no such thing as video art. It's all cinema."
Oh, wow. Well, I'm
and I said, "Well, you know, we can say that. We don't let that."
That's an old
she said that recently.
No, it's just a couple years ago.
That's recently.
But also, there's no more film. It's all digital now.
Right.
So. Yeah. I had to argue with my film department colleagues in the new director series to take on video. It was like,
yeah. Well,
do you think there's a resistance to that's analogous or parallel in the present? Is there another event going on this evening where media artists make art that's web-based and internet-based are at the margin?
Well, they're not even
at the margin. They're not at the margin.
I mean, you know,
web-based.
When I was on...
I don't understand what you mean.
Well, I mean, if you're a web designer, I mean...
No, I'm not talking about a web designer.
I
noticed that artists make a lot of work with various media technology that looks like the internet, but very few artists have occupied the space of the internet as a art medium.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
In
1996, Mark Tribe started an organization called Rhizome.
Rhizome
is
the only game in town.
But
we got one.
But it's not just a game in town. It's a it's an organization for artists all over the world who are working in that space.
But I got their email today, I should read it on my phone, pleading for the art world and for people to apply for some money they have because they feel a vacuum of artists being interested in web-specific or in the internet. It's written by Rhizome. People make art with our contemporary technology that looks like the internet, behaves like the internet. It's a funny representation of the thing that's out there that we all experience. But we would be at a bit of a loss to come up with the vital people making work specifically for the internet and the web and that being a part of our purview as people who look at art.
But there are other entities. Of course, there's Rhizome. There's one called Hyphen Hub. There's one called Lisa.
I can name them all. I could go on and on, but I'm saying it's a very marginalized community, and I wonder if there's a parallel in their sense of resistance to abuse of technology. Have you had ever thought about that?
Well, I mean, I think there's a fairly large scale called disappointment, probably an understatement, in what the internet has become, in the same way that there was a disappointment in what cable television had become. I mean, the internet is just another bank, just another expression of global corporate banking power. It's what it is. It's also brought us a lot of horrible things, as well as it's brought us a lot of freedom. So, would we have Donald Trump running for president without the internet?
Yeah, but that's like saying television was the technology always has aspects to it that are owned by the culture and it's most vulgar.
But I'm just saying it's no longer the ideal space that artists in the early 90s imagined it would be.
I'm not so sure about that.
You think it is an ideal space?
I don't think there is such a thing anywhere, on the internet or in hard copy, but I think it's not that we don't know.
Well,
and then because you can't
make money on it. The bloom is off the rose, let's just put it that way. It's not the kind of totally open territory that Andrew imagined it would be.
That was real Kool-Aid drinking that the internet was going to save us. That's when we think that technology is like a savior.
It's not that people thought technology was going to save them, but they thought it was going to create more interesting kind of relationship. And it may still. I think we're still in an early stage. But the full impact of fully portable technologies is not really hit.
Well, one reason I
and a generation of artists who grew up like my grandson have not come into the world, making and exchanging ideas and images using, whatever systems are out there. So I think you might be a little premature to think that the internet is no longer viable.
I was the one who said it was. You were the one who said it was. The bloom was off.
Wasn't that clever of me?
I'm of the opposite. I think it's very underexplored, and I grapple with the whys of it that might be in addition to commerce. But one thing I wanted to bring up, because maybe you have some questions also, is that three accidental academics, who are now academics, had curator artist lives. And I wonder if a conversation like this is blurring around you now about contemporary technology comes into your thinking in your departments, Yale, SVA, London, in terms of what the heck is our relationship technology. I think it's easy to say we wouldn't have Donald Trump, but let's bang away at how horrible the internet is. But in fact, in a more serious way, I'm just quoting it.
But I don't think it's hard. I just think it's not as interesting as people thought it was going to be. I think that.
But it isn't over. I mean, we're just.
I didn't say it's over either. I just said it.
What did you say? The bloom is off.
The bloom is off the rose.
It's normal.
It's just like it's a pencil.
It's a normal stage.
So, there are a lot of pencils in the world, and there aren't that many great poets.
So at SVA and Yale, your relationship to digital media technology and pedagogically speaking is.
I mean, I look at things. I don't try to push artists to do anything. I've always been in the kind of wonderful position to be able to learn from and respond to what young artists are doing around me. I see some using new technologies like, you know, digital technologies and the internet, but I also see people going back to, you know, to drawing and to working with objects and to painting and
not feel,
yeah, go
back.
Go
back.
They feel that.
You mean go back. they feel like they're making
a historical movement to a decision to go and use an antique medium, you know, stained glass,
video.
Oil paint, video.
Cameras.
Well, I'm in the lucky position that teaching at Yale, Yale doesn't have a media department, it has a photography department that's very, very strong. Has nobody really teaching video. It's got John Bach, who does, you know, very active with performance. So what I do through a kind of history of media is take students in an art historical way with lots of reading and papers through, you know, from like Ben Elman and E&T and other experimental activities, you know, mentioning ETC and showing work too, taking them up to the present. Last year I had the first music student. These are all graduate students, and I was very happy to have a music student because I'm very interested in that those mix. And I don't, like you, I'm always looking, so the students come to me and they, you know, I always say to them, in this class I will show you almost anything. So tell me what you can't see, you know, and I'll work hard to get it. So some of them work with sound, and sound is not taught there. Some of them do installation.
Yeah, I guess I've been curious as both an artist, but certainly also as an academic, about the absence or the presence of a critical relationship to contemporary technology. And that includes the way we use it as makers of work. You know, you buy something off the shelf, it kind of makes the work if you don't wrestle it into your self-made work. You know, you'll make, I see work all the time, it looks like a particular piece of technology or equipment or program. And I wonder also, so that's one aspect, how liberated are we from dictates built into programs? Politically, what is our relationship to technology in terms of commerce? I don't think it's a pencil. I think there are, yet, I think millions and millions of people, you know, I know we're talking about us, but I think these things matter, and I wonder if they matter to you.
Well, I think I also bring that up with the students and talk about it with the work I show, or, you know, it's very much discussed, and I push and try to get them to, you know, you read the New York Times, well, whose point of view is it? It's a point of view. You know, you can like it or you don't like it, but you've got to understand that it's a point of view, the same way that a software is.
Well, I also teach a video history course at SBA. It takes two semesters to do it, because you need at least 30 weeks, 3 hours a week to get a reasonable amount of material shown. And basically the idea of this course is very simple, which is that there are a lot of people, a lot of young artists making video, and they don't get a chance to see what several generations now before them did, because it's just not available. Some of it's available on YouTube in a very kind of, really looking bad. And so I feel a responsibility to letting artists see the real thing, and not just excerpts, but whole works, and long and complicated works. You know, all of Vito's red tapes are the great works. He made the last video we made really, before.
76.
I just made one with him this year for
what
a show. I just made a video with Vito this year for a show in Hiroshima, but that's another story. Yeah, it was hard to get him to do it because he's not interested in having it anymore. And you know, it's quite a simple process for us, as far as I'm concerned, which is just making sure they've seen work done by now and just let them see that and let that sink in, let them steal from it, because that's what artists do. You know, the best artists steal great ideas and make them their own. And if there's only, there's one thing I just put out there, which is that, and I think it relates to how you began your work at Modern, which is that we, whether you make conceptual art or not, we are in the post-conceptual era, and the idea comes first. And all I'm concerned about is that artists start with an idea and then figure out how they're going to execute it, using whatever tools they want, using whatever approach to an audience or engagement with a public that they, that makes sense to the work. For me, I'm not interested in video as a technology or any technologies anymore per se, except as a kind of a figure who somehow is identified with this medium since it was my first serious job, and I have this history, and I have access to these people, so I'm happy to share that. But quite frankly, I think more like Amy Talbot in a weird way, that the video history has merged with the history of art in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It's not an isolated history. It's part of the history of conceptual art and radical political art. And it deserves to be integrated, not maintained in its kind of isolation, the way you were at the Modern, the way I was at museums as well. When I got to the Berkeley Museum, I was chief curator. I said, we're not going to have a video. We're not going to have a video curator, a video department. If the curators who are doing contemporary art don't know about video and painting and sculpture and drawing and photography, you can't call yourself a curator of contemporary art. So there's no, the idea of specialization and the kind of way in which video is ghettoized, I don't buy that anymore.
But I think that's too important in this context as well, schools, where that ghettoization of there's a practice and it has a wall around it, somebody must declare that as a major duty.
Yeah, that's terrible.
And then that, and then that, and then that, whereas the fusing and the crossing and the kind of porousness between so-called technologies, since stuff in a tube is a technology.
But the unfortunate thing is that, unlike a MoMA, has become, I was a little less balkanized, but I think a lot of these art departments are very balkanized.
Well, so, they're carrying the legacy, and it's very hard to shed is all that I can see.
But also,
chipping,
but what I also would love to see more written about is the impact of video on the other mediums, like a Richard Serra, I feel he got boxed into a corner at a point and was making film and video, and it was a way to get out.
Well, but it was a way of drawing.
Ideas
that made sense to him then. And then he was able to take those ideas and work with them at another level with other materials. And so, again, I don't think the hierarchies are necessary.
Yeah.
I recognize the divisions with institutions because conservators...
It's housekeeping. It's
conservators rule museums. And so, you have to store prints and photographs differently than the way you store paintings. And you have to take care of them differently. And that is part of the primary responsibility of institutions to maintain these objects in perpetuity. So I respect that, but we shouldn't, we shouldn't look at it, we shouldn't mistake the menu for the food. And these structures are more like menus, and the food is somehow gone, we don't think about that part of it.
Have thoughts occurred to any of you, or questions?
Yes. First of all, thank you very much. It's really great coming here and hearing you talk about video. I've really enjoyed it. But I can't help but be curious within the context of a panel discussion at a show about the Experimental Television Center that what I heard was mostly, the narrative was mostly about the same characters, Nam June Paik, Vito Acconci, people who are not ETC.
I was very happy that those were the first two artists mentioned in this evening's talk. I'm serious. And that they were a part of an important museum's early embracing of media-based work.
But I don't know if that's what he's getting.
No, that's not what I'm getting. I can ask my question.
Many people who have gone through ETC.
And even when you talked about people who are involved with technology, you didn't mention David Jones, Paul Davis, or Richard Brewster, and I didn't really hear any mention of Experimental Television Center artists, except for a couple, Shigeko, who also happened to reach the higher echelon in the museums. So I'm curious why.
Let me finish the question.
Let me just finish the question.
I was 73, I wasn't over there much.
So the whole question includes suggestions, say within the torrent river of video that the Experimental Television Center represented a tributary,
sure.
which maybe we'll call image processing. So was this tributary marginalized? Are you suggesting the artists are marginal artists? Are we suggesting that these other first-generation artists who reached the upper echelons, there was no room after them? I'm curious why, in this context of ETC, not hearing about ETC artists.
I'm happy to answer that to a certain extent. I think I was pretty honest in saying that I actually didn't like a lot of that work. So as a curator, I was more interested in narrative work and overtly political work. That was my own bias as a young curator. And so I saw a lot of it. I moved to California in 1974, and so I was much more involved in the scene in LA and in San Francisco than in the upstate New York scene. I know who Dave was, and I've seen his work, but I didn't know him or the work intimately. I didn't collect it. In San Francisco, Steve Beck had the National Center for Experiments in Television in Berkeley. And, I liked his work, but I thought it was limited, and I thought it was decorative, and it not as interesting on a decorative level as artists who were painting on a decorative level. Artists who were coming through Holly's gallery and doing more joyous and beautiful decorative work being done non-technologically, and so I thought that was limited. That was my own taste, but I was one person, right? So I wasn't a taste maker. Except within my little framework. But that work never found its way into the culture through other people as well. I mean, I will admit that it was not my primary interest. I did no exhibitions, maybe one exhibition of purely an abstract synthesized video. They were always in my group shows, but I never did a major one-person show, with the exception of Namjoon, who we're talking about, in my opinion, someone who's like Picasso. I mean, Namjoon Paik was one of the great intellects of the 20th century, not just a great artist, he's an extraordinary, extraordinary human being. And so the fact that I get, if I go overboard about Namjoon, it's because he deserves it. And this is one of the greatest artists who ever lived.
So, I mean, I can probably answer similar to David. I really tried in those, especially the early years to, Ernie Casella I showed, but Ernie used to say, Barbara, you're very Catholic. Meaning that I was broad, and I really did try to understand image processing myself, and I did a number of shows, or I incorporated it when I could. I even took a course at Dolphin Computer Animation, and to try to understand what this was,
It's kind of an interesting and curious. I'm not answering your question straight up. I'm sorry, but like. I think about it frequently, how abstraction in the moving image and through technology has never, gotten a lot of traction over this 40 years that we could say from 71, to the present. And I'm just making an observation. I've thought about it frequently because I teach here and I have time-based and media students. Every once in a while, someone becomes really interested in our contemporary, technology being the means, the pencil for what might be called abstraction. But it's an oddity and a curiosity.
I think your question is well raised. This is an exhibition about ETC. We didn't do a lot of talking about ETC except for our. In the engagement we had in it, we knew the place, we knew the people there. I did an early exhibition of their work, but the conversation here has been more broadly about the history of video. So your question.
Yeah, that's what this evening is was a context for ETC, not just a let's talk about an experimental television.
Well, I'd be the wrong person.
Exactly, we have the first two curators of video. And I've been a minor agent in mapping out some of the history and some of the dynamics of that time, not Experimental Television Center specific.
Maybe along similar lines, is there a moment in which the live performance of video, of manipulation, is considered them a document or recorded. And maybe you all could talk about the trajectory more broadly of how video art is considered a kind of a live performance medium as opposed to a document. And you would, something like VJing or video mixing is ubiquitous. And
today it is, yes.
Today, but I think it always has been because broadcast television.
That's a very good point. You know, I think that I hadn't paid enough attention to that as a root of something very common today, which is video DJing. But you're right. I think some of those early, even though they weren't all as sophisticated, some of those early efforts to do that in real time were quite popular.
And those interactions between an instrument and the technology, and now we have greater facilities
and
to
also
have those interactions.
Joan Jonas doing Mirage at Anthology Film Archives in 1975, where she had film projection, she had video pre-recording, she had herself there, she had a live camera, she stripped naked and had a mirror and went down her body. So. Yes, time, and then that was acquired. She, like Carol Lee Schneemann, wouldn't do some of those early performances again because either she moved on or she's not the young, beautiful woman that she was. So she locks it down as an installation with all of the elements.
The document on Mirage is a beautiful document.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
It's really
no, but it's like. But it's not like just a video of it. It's Joan very carefully saying, I'm taking these channels of film and video. And
well, you know, one of the things that was clear at a certain point was that there was such a thing as a dumb document. You know, a lot of performance dancers and people just would set up a camera in the corner and just make a dumb document of a thing, which would be great to have, you know, especially if it was a performance that was never repeated again. It was great to see it. And then there are artists like Joan, Charlemagne Palestine also did this.
And we're studying him.
Who said, well, okay, we can make the document a function of the piece by finding ways of editing that are specific to this medium, that use other kinds of special effects and do other things. Yeah.
And so
that difference is something that developed as video editing developed in the late 70s, as it became possible to do clean video edits, and it wasn't. You're probably too young to know, but in the video editing in the early 70s was just impossible. You just could not make clean edits. So, there was more than one reason why Bruce Nauman just let the camera run for 60 minutes, which was that what was he going to do anyway? You know, he was just going to walk back and forth, or up and down or whatever. And it was sculpture. It wasn't cinema. He wasn't interested in editing that. He was just interested in that as a sculptural experience. A sculptural choreographic experience. But later you had many people doing what was this?
There were no accessible editing systems back in the early 70s. I mean, people were editing quarter pack tapes.
It was hilarious.
With a stopwatch and pieces of paper that figured out the space that you had.
When I got to the Long Beach Museum in 75, I got a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to buy the first kind of computer edit controlled open reel editing system. It was a disaster, but it kind of worked for a couple of weeks, and it was amazing that you could push a button, another button, and kind of time.
Jerry Regan.
And time it, and an artist started coming and using that. And it made a big difference in the video that was being made in Southern California, because now people could actually make clean edits and do things that they've been able to do in film on another level.
But I think that speaks to the gentleman's point that performance really. Went hand in hand with early video because you weren't making edits, you sort of performed, you set up a situation and you performed.
Sure.
And it carries on today as successful.
I mean, if you think of Vito Acconci's piece Claim that he did at 112 Green Street, right, where he was kind of had hypnotized himself at the bottom of the stairs and he was sitting there with a lead pipe threatening to smash anybody who came down the stairs. But and the people watched it upstairs on a black and white. This gray and white monitor in the space. Nobody went down those stairs because he was going to kill you with that pipe if he did. And so there was this live, it was video theater, video performance. There is a video tape of that, an excerpt but it doesn't have the power of it. You know, it's and part of the problem is, you know, that to, you know, it's the old "you had to be there" line. The energy of the piece was in the room and it was live, and the fact that they were using a video monitor and a video camera, that was interesting, but it didn't necessarily mean that the piece was going to live as a document with anything remotely like the power of the initial event. And artists knew that then. And most of them, you know, felt kind of pressured sometimes to put a document out, you know, and so that somebody could have it, but it wasn't the same.
And also in response, it's a bit of history, I always found it really fascinating that rather than put the camera outside of the performance area, Joan took it into the live performance and gave the camera a role in the performance, so that one always had multiple kinds of time. You had real time. She would also have some pre-recorded material, and then that live, the camera was in the performance. And eventually, that became very wonderfully elaborate in her work. And now, it's on every Broadway stage, there's a lot of...
Stan Douglas just did the...
It's become a way of working. You get these multiple kinds of time in one moment and different scales of visual, like a close-up and the actual person on the scene. And that multiplicity of both the time and the POV of the viewer through a camera or the actual distance of the room.
The first artist who did a piece that really affected me that way was Charlotte McDonald's. And he did these dance pieces where he held the camera and kind of moved and smashed into the walls or whatever as he was moving in wider circles. And even the videotapes of that are great because you're just, you know, it's right there and it has that energy.
Did I see another
wave?
Made me think about, when you were talking about
the
something that really isn't
like
television.
I can't hear you.
Isn't that all kind of like television anyway? The mix of pre-recorded material that looks up this action, this idea of performance, the idea that everybody who watches television knows that TV is being made, that crew exists somewhere, maybe.
Yeah, but I was talking about work that was made in 1971.
Right, I know.
I don't know what television was then, or I mean, I don't know if there's an analogy to TV of the 70s in that. I don't really see that.
I mean, you know, portable.
I mean, I'm not talking about a postmodern idea that the apparatus is revealed.
Right.
No, I'm not talking about that.
Yeah. Barbara just mentioned a very important name.
Ernie Kovacs. Some of you may have seen recently up in the Jewish Museum had a show, and I think Ernie Kovacs was on view if you hadn't.
I showed Ernie Kovacs in my first week of my video history class.
Yeah. No, it's like he and Averty in France were like just. Brilliant.
Is that what you mean? Like there were these examples of people who were using the technology?
Not only examples, but I also just think that a lot of the, I don't know, I just think that actual just regular production methods for just standard television.
I never saw in standard regular TV that you'd have a close-up simultaneously with the actual scale of the person, with pre-recorded timing, this kind of composited.
I think I'm just thinking more of the language of these things being filtered. I think the things are being separated more than they should be, but that language existed, it was on people's minds.
It was on people's minds
in the TV and the internet. TV hadn't worked so much on the internet. Like TV didn't die. Like TV just got bigger and bigger.
Well, TV definitely didn't die, but I think the language of broadcast television camera work was absolutely affected by the availability of lightweight cameras. And when lightweight cameras happened, you know, you had brilliant people working in broadcast television who also had ideas about cool things to do. Some of them also saw independent work and were informed by them. In my mind, there's no doubt that Dan June Pike's early music-related works had an enormous influence on music videos and on that whole industry, which did not exist, you know, for 15 years before Dan June was making music videos. And then that whole industry grew up around that. Some of those people saw that, saw those works.
No one is in the bubble. No one's working in the bubble.
No, of course, that's why it's...
So I'm sorry if I was being obtuse and missing your point, but I didn't know that was the point. Sorry.
I can speak to that point. I worked many years with Neptune from, I guess, 81 to 96. And so one of the experiences about how some of that got into television was, and I think Hank, right, said something about access. So in the 80s, it was very expensive to get digital effects access and things like that. So there were certain things called Neon, standby program, and other places where they would